thank you very much to IRAC organizers for inviting me to speak. I'm very pleased to be a part of the IRAC group, and I am very pleased to be part of this meeting to discuss this important topic. When I gave the title to Gary Thompson when he called, I actually, like several other speakers today, spoke before I thought more quietly about who else was going to be on the symposium agenda, so I've modified it a little bit. My plan is to hit four major points, to talk about vector control as it exists today. Specifically, I'll come back to something that was said about the size of the market, to describe the options that are available to public health control managers, to do as I, as the title indicated, to mention the implications for vector behavior and ecology, and then to make a plea about the advice. What I think I have to offer you is to reflect back to entomologists what I hear as a sort of a bridge person from physicians and other public health experts who really are bewildered. They're on the right page, their hearts are in the right place, and they need to find a way forward. Okay. We, at the Gates Foundation, we commissioned an analysis of the public health pesticides market. And here are summary data. Here, the next several slides present summary data from that report. If you would like to have a copy of the report, you can write to me, and I will be glad to send it out. We have sent out 500 electronic copies to date, but you know, another 500 is just fine. They're all PDFs that are easy to email. This is an example from malaria funding, but it illustrates the point that the funding for classic public health vector control is increasing dramatically. Let's see if I can use the mouse. There we are. From 2003 onward, the expenditures have only increased. The yellow is from the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and malaria. The middle green is USAID, and the darker green from the World Bank Booster Program. These are funds contributed for central campaign style, centrally managed campaign style malaria control programs. This figure also illustrates the point that these are donor-driven programs, and as much as donors can have a lot of enthusiasm and money, they can also have donor fatigue, and so it contributes to an uncertainty in the market. This is for all of malaria control. Here is a figure to describe the expenditures on vector control, and this includes dengue and malaria as the primary contributors. There is also some amount of expenditure for control of leishmaniasis, for African trypanosomiasis, but these are relatively minor components. The leftmost column reflects insecticide-treated nets, either conventionally treated nets or long-lasting nets, and in 2006, the global spending was about $400 million, of which $350 million were in the textile itself, and $50 million were the chemical that's applied to or incorporated inside the chemical, the textiles. Space spray, which is commonly used to control outbreaks of dengue fever, is another $136. Indoor residual spray in 2006 was only $124 million. This is the number where we expect to see the greatest increase because of the increase in the President's Malaria Initiative and the Global Fund programs on malaria control. Larvicides, another almost $92 million. So the total public health pesticide product market in 2006 is $750 million, of which only $400 million is the actual chemicals. So when you're talking about what does a company need to see in terms of a market to justify an investment, we heard it's notionally $250 million to develop a product, and the entire public health market is $400 million in 2006. It will grow, but how far will it grow and in what ways will it grow is not clear. What this figure does not capture is the fact that the market is fragmented. Morteza Zaim estimates that there are over 5,000 producers. I'm reporting to you faithfully, but I still can't quite get my mind around it. 5,000 producers of public health pesticide chemicals. So this is $400 million divided by a stupid number that's just too big to be believed, and the amount that any individual company can realize in terms of its return is much lower. This is my favorite graph from that report, however. This figure represents the relationship between consumer products and public health pesticide products. Again, these are 2006 data. It shows you the vector control product sales by region and channel. So if you look, the vertical axis is a percentage, and the horizontal axis shows you different regions. Here we have, see if I can do this, Asia, Europe, Latin America, Africa, North America, the Pacific region. This corresponds roughly to the WHO regions. In Asia, the dark green represents the amount of money spent by families, by individuals, on consumer products. Mosquito coils, aerosol cans of insecticide, emanators, consumer products, which is $4.7 billion, billion dollars, compared to the 20-something million dollars spent on public health vector control. The white section is PCO, professional, pest control operators. Even in Africa, the poorest region, the majority of the expenditure is on consumer products. So a company setting out to sell an active ingredient, these are the same pyrethroids as a class, at least, in most of these consumer products, has more than the $400 million market to look into, and possibly as much as $8.5 billion. This is, to me, incredibly encouraging in terms of stimulating public investment or private sector investment. Again, those are 2006 data. They're estimated from visits to 11 countries, and then data collected by various means from commercial data. Companies that collect these data, as well as the WHO. The reasons for the tremendous increase in vector control is obvious. The reasons are just straightforward. They save lives. All these interventions save lives. Recent reports from Kenya suggest that at high coverage, long-lasting nets can be associated with a 40% reduction in all-cause mortality among users. That's huge. Even at low coverage, long-lasting nets have something called personal protection, which is much discussed and debated, but to me the good news is that we're no longer targeting low coverage as an endpoint. Indoor residual spray reduces vector abundance dramatically, and those reductions are associated with reductions in parasite prevalence and in transmission. There were recent reports at the ASTMH about the use of larval control and integrated vector management that showed a reduction in transmission again. This is the first report that I'm aware of, this is from Western Kenya, where they actually linked the application of larvicide to reduction in overall mosquito abundance and a reduction in transmission of the disease in question, which was malaria. Now, there's a caveat there. The same reports described the same products being used in the Gambia, and there, just as people sometimes feared, there was not only not a reduction in overall adult abundance, there was an increase in abundance and an increase in transmission. So we have to be a little careful about larvicides, but the big picture, the headline is vector control saves lives. There are some uses still that are questioned, and I will just put these out here in hopes that you all will come and put a flea in my ear later on about why this is not true. We and the Gates Foundation, we've been refreshing our strategy with respect to different diseases, and in the process we consult outside experts. We just finished malaria over the summer and fall, and now we're working on dengue, on African trypanosomiasis, on filariasis, etc. And there the jury's still out. There is a significant fraction of the dengue community who think that vector control is not worth pursuing, that it's unsustainable and cost inefficient. In the arena of African trypanosomiasis, sleeping sickness, the major remaining vector is the Pal Palus group flies, and the conventional wisdom, at least, is that they do not have an odor response. I think that's actually been disproven by now. So this is so ingrained that the WHO approach is to screen and treat the human population to remove the reservoir of infection. The global program for the elimination of lymphatic filariasis similarly has focused on mass drug administration alone, ignoring vector control. Just now we're seeing the beginning of research programs to explore the ways in which vector control can help with elimination of filariasis. Even though it's highly effective, it saves lives, no one's confused, it's onerous and costly. The world targets for malaria control are 80% coverage. These are called the Abuja targets. 80% coverage with effective diagnosis, treatment, and prevention. And in order to reach 80% coverage with either IRS, indoor residual spray, or long-lasting nets, it would cost about $4 billion a year in perpetuity. And this is 4/7 of the global total for all of malaria control. This is not a sustainable number. The overall expenditures today are about $1 billion a year for malaria. There's significant manpower costs. Long-lasting net distribution is, for now, piggybacked in a variety of systems. You distribute them through antenatal clinics. You distribute them with measles immunization campaigns. You distribute them by this and this and this method. If you intend to reach 100% coverage, we have to get serious about this, and it's going to take a serious level of effort with manpower that doesn't presently exist. Larval control can be similarly labor-intensive. In the examples that I was talking about from the ASTMH meeting, they required weekly applications and weekly surveys. There are technical challenges. And my point in bringing these up is to say to you, we can do better than this. We should not stint. When my public health colleagues hate for me to put up this slide, at no time am I suggesting that we should stop using indoor residual spray or long-lasting nets or integrated vector management. We need to pursue it as vigorously as possible. But here, we have a group of experts and creative individuals who can think quietly. These are the shortcomings of the present tools, which we can use to design better ones. Insecticide resistance has been discussed. There are only four classes of adulticide in use for public health pesticides today. I actually want to challenge that. I would love for someone to tell me why all of those chemical classes below your line have no value in public health. I actually don't understand it. And I will quote a specific paper that I saw recently about spinosad. It's a paper by Mueller and Schlein in Israel, where they identified the sugar meal sources of their favorite mosquito, whatever it may be, some plant. Then they sprayed that plant with spinosad, and guess what? All the mosquito population crashed. Now, what I do understand about the ecology of Israel is that the number of different plant species is very small, is relatively low. And so I would like to see this repeated in an area which has much more abundant and lush vegetation. But I only cite it to try and plant a seed of debate. Why are these more modern, safer, better chemicals not available in public health? I don't actually know that, and I would love to just try some of these things out and find out. And if 3/4 of them fail, but 1/4 of them work out, then we will have realized, we will have avoided some of the costs of development that went into those products. For now, what do we do about resistance? We have this wonderful set of documents, which I'm very, very grateful for. And we need to work hard at getting them out, but even with these, it's bewildering. And the teams that we have going out to national control programs are routinely met with incredulity. Why should I collect data? What do I do with this data? If I'm interested in distributing long-lasting nets, there's only one class of chemicals applied or incorporated into those nets. So if there's resistance, there's resistance. What am I going to do about it? I still have to give out the nets. I have no options. There are issues of accessibility, not only of vectors to the intervention, but of the disease endemic areas to control. The example in India of leishmaniasis control with indoor residual spray with DDT, teams can only get out there for about 1 month a year. The roads are otherwise impassable. It has to be sustainable. I can't tell you how many times someone has told me, vector control, it's a foolish idea. Look, Sri Lanka did it, it was fine, then they stopped and it came right back. In fact, in India, they've suppressed malaria transmission over and over again. But somehow we have to find a way to make it stick. There are issues of acceptability. Net owners are not necessarily net users. I had the horrifying, tragic experience of having lunch with the manager of a long-lasting net distribution program in a major African country that's made phenomenal strides. It has brought down malaria transmission and is one of the success stories. She's just a genuine heroine. She works horrible long hours. She juggles her family life. She has no resources, no manpower, no staff, and she spends 1 week a month going out to see for herself how the distribution system is going to make sure that things are going well, and she pushes as hard as she can. When she goes out to the field, to rural areas, she doesn't sleep under a net because it's too uncomfortable and inconvenient. We also know that there are a lot of refusals when spray teams come along to apply indoor residual spray. I don't have to mention environmental and human safety concerns, I think, to this crowd. There are other issues related to the vector behavior and ecology that influence controllability of vectors and of disease. The first report that I found of vector behavior influencing the effectiveness of indoor residual spray came from the Garki project, a project in northern Nigeria, where they used indoor residual spray in combination with Mass Drug Administration trying to interrupt transmission of malaria. They concluded that it was impossible because they could not remove all of the sporozoite containing anophelines from the area, and they investigated numerous options. The one that they concluded was by far the most likely was that the outdoor feeding behavior confounded the impact of indoor residual spray. So the IRS did wonders for the indoor feeding mosquitoes, but it didn't touch the outdoor feeding ones. There are a lot of discussions about insecticide repellency and toxicity. There's a recent report by Grieco et al. Talking about spatial repellency. Lucia Manga, who would have been here today, has several publications in this field. This is actually a confusing situation to people from a public health perspective. On the one hand, you hear that if a compound has excitorepellency, then it's less suitable for indoor residual spray than one without, because the excitorepellency might limit the dose which is absorbed by the mosquito through its tarsi. On the other hand, other people say that if a product functions primarily as a repellent, then there's less opportunity to select for resistance because resistance to the toxicity doesn't confer any benefit. There are studies illustrating the differential impact of long-lasting nets in China or in Central America compared to Africa. Because the mosquitoes are exophagic in China, there is a much lower impact of long-lasting nets than in Africa. And here the authors are Joe Lines and Nigel Hill. There are studies of insecticide resistance in Culex. One of the problems with acceptability of either IRS or long-lasting nets in Africa is that people say, well, I don't believe you're actually killing any mosquitoes. They're still everywhere. My house is full of them. These are the ones that you can find remaining are the nuisance mosquitoes, the Culex, which are much more highly resistant to insecticides than the anophelines. The most interesting explanation for why Culex are more resistant to pyrethroids than anophelines is this, that the culex larval breeding sites are much more polluted, but have much lower oxygen tension, and so they have much higher baseline levels of metabolizing enzymes. And it is metabolic resistance that's found in the culex. We talked earlier about the differential impact of larvicides in different settings. So these are examples in the recent literature of how vector behavior and ecology influence controllability. So what I was saying to you is that I hope I can reflect back to you how this looks to the control program manager. I'm the hapless manager of the Zambia Malaria Control Program. I'm the lady who's responsible for vectors, for long-lasting nets and indoor residual spray. And we've heard that I have very few options available. If I'm talking about nets, there's only one chemical class. If I'm talking about IRS, there are four classes, but there's this confounding problem of the cross-resistance. Larvicides are not universally feasible. When we sent a team out, as I said before, to survey these countries, we asked them how do they make their decisions about which products and which approaches to use. The first criterion is affordability and cost effectiveness. Now, this is different than cost. It has to do with price points. It has to do with how much money you have to spend, with how many human resources you need to mobilize. There's an element of funders' preferences. Indoor residual spray has been promoted by the USAID, and I actually am quite delighted about that, but there is an element of funders' preferences involved. There has to be validated efficacy of a product in the local market. I guess it hasn't been mentioned here, but it's clear from all of our industrial contacts that it's necessary to duplicate country by country the registration of individual products for individual uses. So this is just very time-consuming and repetitious and expensive. There are issues of safety and ease of implementation that are brought up. So here's our approach to this problem. Again, this is the illustration from malaria, which we have sorted out, and we're addressing now other diseases. In order to reach even the Abuja targets, which require contributions and expenditures in perpetuity, just control malaria to a certain point and hold it there, it would require about $7 billion a year. Of that, about $4 billion is for vector control. Right now, the world is spending $1.3 billion a year. The gray there is the Global Fund. The sort of tan is President's Malaria Initiative, yellowish World Bank. The important thing to notice there is the light blue. Endemic countries themselves are spending their own money. And then there are funds from the private sector, of which we are only one part, I'm very proud to say. So, $1.3 billion up to $7 billion, what are we going to do to close the gap? Well, we can increase our advocacy efforts. We can increase global, domestic, and private sector expenditures in this regard. That's ongoing. It's happening. It's true. It's not going to get us to $7 billion a year, much less get us to $7 billion a year in perpetuity. So the other opportunity that we have to close this gap is to decrease the amount of funding required by designing more efficient delivery systems and developing more cost-effective tools. And again, this is something that our first speaker mentioned, is that we want to work together with academia and industry to identify ways to improve our tools. And the improvements can be either incremental improvements, longer-lasting formulations of existing chemicals, or they can be transformational. So maybe, I'm looking at Katie, maybe I'll just say we have a project called the Innovative Vector Control Consortium, of which Janet Hemingway is the director, that is one public-private partnership to develop new tools and new monitoring tools for vector control. But there are other activities that are taking place and need to take place, and I hope that we will be able to discuss those more thoroughly. The bottom line is that we have to do a better job, and we're committed to trying. For right now, my goal for this talk was to to give each of you the vocabulary, the perspective you need to engage in these conversations yourselves much more thoroughly with public health officials, with national control program managers, with researchers, with industry. I think that if we all work together, surely we will be able to do a better job. In terms of improving the efficiency of delivery systems, the obvious solution is to improve vector monitoring. But managers, as I mentioned, are not convinced why they need to do it. They have the guideline to set aside 15% of their donor funds for monitoring and evaluation. And they say, what am I going to do with this data? Who's going to collect it? How much will it cost to collect it? If I had the data, what would I do with it? This whole notion that vector behavior and ecology are important is just staggering and overwhelming. Yes, okay, we've got it. Vector control has to be tailored to the local situation. We know this. But now I'm sitting in Papua New Guinea, and I'm wondering, I have how many islands to deal with, you know, with how many different ecologies. What am I supposed to do with this? What we need to do is to have the conversation in a very concrete, specific way to help people design new programs. I had down here that there are technical challenges associated with data collection, and that Janet Hemingway would talk about them. I hope that that someone can do that or not. We can also maybe give her some opportunity to send something in. So the bottom line is, we need sound advice. And IRAC, thank you very much for all your hard work. Has been very active and helpful. There's also WHO, which has been attempting, they have a new program, or a newly invigorated program, it's a long-standing program, to provide specific technical advice to national control programs on insecticide resistance monitoring. Not only advice, but training. And they are the hosts, I guess, of a database called the African Network of Vector Resistance, ANVR, that is meant to collect data at least continent-wide on resistance to anophelines. Then the last project I wanted to mention is one that I've recently become aware of. It's a joint effort of the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, UN Environment Program, and the WHO Pesticide Evaluation Scheme to strengthen national registration authorities in countries to support the implementation of the International Code of Conduct for Safe and Judicious Use of Pesticides. That includes things like quality control, includes things like post-registration monitoring, and also to create a database of all insecticide uses, including agriculture as well as public health. And while these data have notable gaps, there are still, because they're consistently collected, they'll give us a view of trends over time. So these are the beginnings of dialogues, and for which I'm very grateful, and I hope there will be lots more, and I'm happy to take any questions.
All due respect to our Gates Foundation, actually targeting one aspect but forgot the other aspect. So you cannot have one without the other. And that is actually politically motivated. You have to go to the ruler, to the king, to whoever is running there, you know, the thing or the tribesmen, to have that thing in place. And if this is not in place, hey, with all due respect, I mean, we're putting that money down the drain.
So my instructions are to repeat the question or the comment, which is that global development must go hand in hand with public health, that public health alone will not have an impact, and that the world may have forgotten global development. And so what I will say is, from the Gates Foundation perspective, which is all I'm really empowered to discuss, I've only told you what I do. Okay? There is another whole division of people called global development, and they are addressing issues of that sort. So don't be confused that because I only spoke for myself that's all that we're doing. But having said so, there's an interesting set of studies by, a man named Hans Rosling, I think is his name. He has the Gapminder software and some of the related data analysis paradigms. His conclusion is very clear, that global development per se will not bring you health, whereas health can bring you global development. Health is something in which you must invest. And the investment has to be smart, not stupid. You have to invest in health systems. You have to invest in surveillance and monitoring. You have to invest in education. No one's confused. But investments in health will pay off in terms of development, whereas investments in development will pay off in economic terms, but not necessarily improve any of the health statistics you care to monitor. So that's just one data point that actually did a study. There was another question?
Yeah, just to put it into perspective, the figure of roughly $1.6 billion being spent on vector control, the state of Florida expends about $140 million a year on mosquito control. Is that subsumed in that figure? I imagine California must spend, the United States must spend near $300 million on mosquito control.
So the data for the United States were carefully considered, and in fact, I'm not sure, they were vetted with numerous experts in the world. The figures that we presented are the commodity sales only, not the staff, number one. Number two, there was a great debate about what was the appropriate figure in the United States, and there was an effort by the American Mosquito Control Association to collect such data. And they eventually concluded that they were not robust. So we took the more conservative number so as not to mislead our industrial colleagues. But there are much higher estimates for the U.S., which, as you say, are not there because they couldn't be substantiated. Yeah. So in the blue shirt, did you have a question? So yes, we specifically gave them $5 million to strengthen and improve their process. But I will say to you that having engaged with them, what I can report back is that there is not a significant backlog in terms of the HUPIS pipeline today. You can visit the pipeline on its website at any moment. There are certain requirements that are difficult to meet for some of the smaller manufacturers, and I'm talking about the fifth quintile of these 5,000 manufacturers here, about having standard composition and defined GLP production and things like that. There are still some people grumbling. I think the chief bottleneck is not the one meeting a year; it's that when you get to phase two studies, this is odd to me. I don't actually understand it. Help me. They do their phase two experimental HUT studies in an area carefully situated so that natural mosquito populations are tested. So they have to be near riverbanks, near rice paddies, near so and so. In most of the places where they work, the mosquito abundance is highly seasonal. So in order to get a test of a product, a candidate, either net or IRS, they, you know, in this careful Latin square design, it takes 12 weeks. There is a limit to the number of actual physical sites where these things can take place. And so my first question, and it's on the agenda for HOOPIS, is whether we shouldn't dramatically improve the number of sites, not only the number, but their distribution, so that when there are no mosquitoes in Tanzania, there will be mosquitoes in someplace else, so we can spread them around the world. Having said that, when you go to those sites, I've been to two of them, they do not have enough business, enough of a queue to feel safe that that can be their main activity in terms of sustaining their salaries and things like this. So I'm not sure where the backlog is. People talk about it a lot, and I haven't found it yet, but maybe you can help me. In the back, the black jacket? So the question is, why is aerial spray not used for African vectors? And the reason is that they are typically less accessible. They're indoor resting, indoor feeding mosquitoes, and so aerial spray doesn't reach them in to the same way that it does outdoor resting. It's aerial spray is used in Africa for locusts, I think, and for some categories of tsetse fly, which do spend most of their time outdoors, you know, in an area that's accessible to the spray.
But they're breeding outside and then coming inside. If you kill them for black and putting it inside, over time you think the mosquito population will be controlled inside as well.
So the argument for, and in each of these cases I'm reporting to you the conventional wisdom, which I would love to test. In the case of larval breeding sites for anophelines, the conventional wisdom, and it is so far has appears to be true, is that they breed in very fresh, very clean, very transient, ephemeral water bodies that get washed out every time it rains. So it rains today, gets washed out. It rains tomorrow, gets washed out. The mosquito larvae, some of them survive by adhering to the edges, but to treat all of those larval breeding sites with chemicals is really challenging. And one of the most, I started to say ruthless, most intensive studies I've ever seen in my life, it was done by a wonderful woman in Western Kenya, but it really was a heroic effort. So, yeah, it's a good question. Keep thinking. Yeah. In the gray shirt. So yes, there are numerous conclusions and just questions. To me, the amazing thing about the consumer product market is its penetration out into the most rural areas. There was no household that I found that didn't have a mosquito coil. No kiosk, no little bitty kiosk that didn't have mosquito coils. They'd break up the packages of five and sell them one at a time. It's the price point of those things that puts them within reach of families. And as families become more affluent, then they like to buy a can of aerosol and clean out the area of bugs when they have, you know, Aunt Matilda coming to dinner. You know, it's something about distribution channels. What I would like to do, and I'm on this trail, is to work with companies that manufacture those products, A, to test, to see maybe they do work better than the conventional wisdom suggests, and even if they are not yet optimized, then we can use them as a lead to work together to improve it. You know, if coils work, then we should get the word out. If they don't work, we should make one that does, because we clearly have the distribution channels and the market to support it. So, yeah, there are a lot of conclusions, a lot of really cool opportunities and questions that come to mind when you see data like that. Thank you very much.